supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Candidates interested in running for the U.S. Congress anywhere in Pennsylvania have 3 weeks to collect their nominating signatures starting tomorrow. All the district lines have been redrawn by the state Supreme Court after it found the previous districts gerrymandered. That means candidates will have to do a lot in a hurry in territory that may be new to them. Joining me to sort it all out is WHYY's Dave Davies. And Dave, tell us about the nominating petition process that starts tomorrow. What exactly do candidates do?
Well, Dave, this happens for every public office. The idea is that to get on the public ballot, you have to make a good faith showing that you have some support. So to run for Congress, that means you need signatures from 1,000 qualified voters on your nominating petitions. But as you noted, these districts all changed just a week ago. I asked Lawrence Otter, a veteran election lawyer, if that means that a lot of these candidates are going to be sending workers into areas that may be new to them. He said, well, here's what he said.
Yeah, that's for sure. They're going to be collecting signatures in places they didn't know existed, 3 weeks ago. There's going to be some degree of difficulty in this because you have to make sure you collect the signatures of registered voters within your district.
That's right. They have to be registered voters of your party in your district. They have to be 1,000. And because mistakes will happen and petitions can be challenged, you want to get more than 1,000, maybe 2,000 or 3,000. So it's a challenge.
Dave, we had two open seats before the redistricting process in Philadelphia, and especially on the Democratic side, there were a lot of candidates. Now, how did this crop of hopefuls respond to the new districts?
In a lot of different ways, Dave. Yeah, this has been crazy for the candidates and those of us who cover them. Some found that they lived in a different district, so they filed to run in a newly created district, different from the one they'd planned. Some quit. Some ran for other offices. And you're right, there were these two open seats. One was Republican Pat Meehan in Delaware County, who had that sexual harassment scandal. The other was Bob Brady, the longtime Philadelphia Democrat, who was tainted by a different kind of federal investigation. He decided not to run again. And the Brady withdrawal in particular created an interesting situation because his seat was mostly in Philadelphia with parts of Delaware County. More than a half dozen candidates announced they wanted to run for that seat. But as you and I spoke about a few weeks ago, there was a possibility that district would just disappear, which is essentially what happened. One who announced for that seat was Nina Ahmed, a former deputy mayor of Philadelphia. She told me today she likes the fact that the old lines were redrawn. She believes the new districts are more fair.
However, what that did is the first district that I was running in got cut up into three pieces and went to Delaware County District, which is the new 5 and 3 and 2.
That's a little confusing with these numbers because everything got renumbered. But essentially, she was in a position where in order to run in Philadelphia, she would have had to run against one of the Democratic incumbents. She decided not to and will run for lieutenant governor instead. Others made different choices. Kevin Johnson, who was a minister from Overbrook, decided he will take on Congressman Dwight Evans in a new district. And Rich Laser, a former deputy mayor in Philadelphia for Labor, he is expected to announce that next week that he will run for a new seat primarily based in Delaware County, but includes parts of Philadelphia, including his South Philadelphia home. So it's been a crazy, confusing situation.
So, Dave, in trying to make sense of the entire region, what do the districts do for the fortunes of the Republicans and Democrats?
Good question. Well, we essentially have 6 congressional seats here in southeastern Pennsylvania. And under the old map, 3 of those were based in Philadelphia with some suburban component. Those were safe Democratic seats. And there were 3 seats in the suburban counties and beyond that were been pretty safely Republican for a while. With the new map, you're going to have 2 Philadelphia seats and then 1 that's mostly in Delaware County with some Philly. And those are all going to be 3 Democratic-leaning seats. Then we'll have 3 suburban seats, and at least 2 of them will be more competitive. In Montgomery County, which has been trending more Democratic in recent years, there is no incumbent. And in Chester County, the seat held by Republican Ryan Costello, the Democrats think they have a real shot with the new configuration of that seat. The 3rd Republican seat in Bucks County is held by Republican Brian Fitzpatrick. He's going to be tougher to beat. So you could see this region going from a 3-3 Democratic split to one that's 5 Democrats and 1 Republican.
I'm trying to do the arithmetic, but there are still outstanding legal challenges. Could the entire redistricting be reversed?
Yes. The Republican Party says the state Supreme Court didn't have the authority to draw these lines. And if the courts agree, you could see it go back to the earlier lines and you'd have a new scramble for people trying to get petitions in different districts in a very, very compressed timetable. So that would be pretty wild, but it's not impossible.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
WHYY's Dave Davies on Newsworks Tonight. Members of the Trump administration, including Attorney General Jeff Sessions, have repeatedly warned that the policies of so-called sanctuary cities, where police limit their cooperation with federal immigration enforcement, lead to more crime.
It means criminals walk free and victims must suffer in silence.
But sanctuary city leaders argue just as passionately that not cooperating with ICE makes their communities safer. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that it's not clear which side is right.
Bensalem Township Public Safety Director Fred Herron does not like sanctuary cities. Speaking at a township council meeting earlier this year, he made a case for why his police department goes out of its way to work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE.
Two cities, sanctuary cities, one next to us and one an hour and 15 minutes away, you could figure that out, what city that is, has a brother and sister.
He launches into the story of Wanda De Jesus and Edwin Ramirez Marte. He says this brother-sister duo are now behind bars for dealing heroin in Bucks County after having brushes with the law in Philly and New York, both sanctuary cities. Herron says the two will be deported after serving their sentences because they're not in the U.S. legally. Before the meeting, Herron explained that it's not about how many people like De Jesus and Ramirez Marte are out there today. It's about trying to have one less victim tomorrow.
Since 2009, 4% of the people that we arrested were in this country illegally and turned over to ICE. If you were one of that 4% on the victim side, wouldn't you have wanted us to take measures?
That's why, in Bensalem, police will alert ICE anytime they arrest someone they find to be in the country illegally. The thing is, police departments that don't want to work as closely with ICE say they're also motivated by public safety. Michael Chitwood is the police superintendent in Upper Darby in Delaware County.
We could be very, very forceful in taking people off the street because there's a lot of people there illegally.
Like Bensalem, Upper Darby sits next to Philadelphia, the largest sanctuary city in our region. And also like Bensalem, Upper Darby has a large international community that includes some undocumented immigrants. Chitwood says from what he's seen, people in the country illegally tend to be the victims, not perpetrators, of crime.
Usually they're a victim walking home after a long week and they get paid cash and here comes three or four big guys and stick them up, rob them, beat them up. So we see a lot of that.
He and other officials in cities that don't want to be associated with federal immigration enforcement say they need undocumented immigrants to cooperate with them to help solve crimes and make their homes safer. So whose approach is right? There is evidence that immigrant communities commit fewer crimes than native-born Americans. But big picture?
We have no idea.
Jerry Ratcliffe is a criminologist at Temple University.
Any effects on the crime rates, whether the local police department are working with or they're not cooperating with ICE, I think is purely conjecture.
He says that's because police departments don't make a habit of studying those relationships and keeping track of the results. And he's not aware that researchers are either. Tom Gross is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association. He says which camp a police department belongs to depends a lot on politics.
Some of the decision-making comes from their elected body, you know, some mayor, council, whoever's overseeing the chiefs.
And those elected officials may be basing their decisions on what the people who voted for them believe, rather than data. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
When we turn on the tap to get a drink of water, most of us never think about the journey that water takes to get to our faucet. As WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports, a coordinated effort is working to keep Delaware's water clean, starting at the source across the border in Pennsylvania.
This farm near Landenburg in Chester County, Pennsylvania, has been in operation for more than 200 years. It's been run by a member of the Hoops family since 1854. Today, Barkley Hoops raises a few hundred dairy cows on the land.
I just love this land and farm, and so do my children. So hopefully it'll continue on, and it's preserved.
And although it's miles from the Delaware border, these idyllic hills play a big role in the quality of drinking water for thousands of Delawareans. Hidden at the bottom of this valley, this little trickle joins with dozens of others like it on the way to eventually become the White Clay Creek. But as the streams grow in volume, they also pick up nutrients, sediment, and other pollutants along the way. That's a problem for companies like Suez Water, which takes water from the White Clay Creek, treats it, then delivers it to 100,000 Delaware customers. This stream's close proximity to the Hoops Dairy Farm poses a special hazard to Delaware Water customers, according to Suez Water's Tom Hubbard. That hazard is an organism called Cryptosporidium.
It's a parasite, lives in the cow's intestinal tract, and when they do what they do, it gets into the water. But if you keep the cows out of the water, and they're not producing it in the water stream, then you're not having to take it out when it gets down to the treatment plant.
Suez has been working with Hoops and other farmers to move livestock away from the water.
There's no farmer that I know of that wants to pollute the water. And there's a finite amount of water, fresh water, in the world. And we got to keep it clean.
To do that, Hoops is working with Greg Gagliano at Redtail Restoration to plant trees that will help create a 100-foot buffer around the water source.
Here we have a farm where the water, as we all know, is running into the stream off of a dairy operation. As it goes in, it's has an opportunity to percolate through the trees and get cleaner as it goes into those streams, creating cleaner water downstream in Delaware and into ultimately the Delaware Bay.
For Suez, keeping parasites and other pollutants out of the water is much more efficient and economical than treating it downstream.
We were facing a choice. To meet regulations, we could either invest up to $20 million in a treatment plant to add treatment, which would have zoomed the cost up for customers, would have increased our carbon footprint, or we could invest upstream $700,000 over 5 years to do these kinds of projects, and we reach the same goal of reducing pollution.
The Hoops project is just one of more than two dozen water quality projects the company has undertaken. About 10 miles north, workers are putting the finishing touches on another project to protect another source of Delaware's drinking water, the Red Clay Creek.
We're at the headwaters of the Upper East Branch of the Red Clay Creek up in East Marlborough Township in Chester County. And we're on a 90-acre farm where the stream pretty much begins.
Bob Struble is with the Brandywine Red Clay Alliance, a group working to improve water quality in northern Delaware and southeast Pennsylvania.
For example, on this farm, it's a horse farm, so we have a number of horses that are grazing each day. It's a good idea to keep them far back from the stream as you can, so one of our projects here is to put fencing in and keep them at least 35 feet away from the stream.
Just like the Hoops farm, trees will be planted along the water's edge at this horse farm. David Arscott with Stroud Water Research says the trees will help improve water quality downstream in a number of ways.
We have not just moving operations back and creating a buffer to help process and remove excess nutrients or pollutants that might come in there, but once the trees grow up, they shade the stream, they help buffer the temperature changes, they keep the stream water cooler, which can promote better fish communities.
With the buffer, the horses are still given access to the stream, but are limited from standing in the water for a long time. But all these actions are all voluntary. These projects all start with educating landowners and farmers like Barkley Hoops on the impact their land can have on water quality.
We've all got to be good neighbors. I couldn't farm here if I wasn't a good neighbor.
Just as it took years for area streams to become polluted, it will take years for these improvement efforts to have their full impact. From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
If only your car was this reliable more than a decade after the warranty ran out, and this vehicle hasn't been in the shop for all that time as well. Let's look under the hood with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, although it's only gone some 28 miles, it's still a remarkable achievement.
It's got to be one of my favorite stories about space technology, Dave, is the rover Opportunity on the surface of Mars left Earth, 13 years ago, 14 years ago, landed on the surface of Mars with the expectation that it would complete its mission and be done in 9 months. That would be the end of it. And while there have been some glitches along the way, various kinds of hardware problems, there have also been issues of sand traps and crater slopes and dust storms and things of that nature, this spacecraft has found a way to keep going and going and going, to the tune of having returned to us some 225,000 images from the surface of Mars, and confirmation that, indeed, water did exist on Mars at one time in the dim, distant past, and that amount of water was much greater than we ever suspected, and the temperature on Mars was much warmer than we ever expected.
Water did exist on the surface. Water still exists subsurface.
First was, you know, the concept that water could have been there as we look at the geologic features, and then spacecraft like the rover Opportunity and Spirit search around on the surface and come up with evidence of the prior existence of water. Then there's the Phoenix lander, which a few years ago landed near the North Poles of Mars, scratched onto the upper surface of the soil, and just a few centimeters down, found evidence of permafrost. Well, these things kind of confirm the existence of water. I've actually heard it said in this way, that there's enough water frozen into the soil of Mars that if you could melt it all, you could flood the planet, flood the entire planet to a depth of 36 feet.
H2O, like river water, or salt water, like in an ocean?
Obviously, because it's a liquid that has percolated somehow through the soils of Mars, there will be some mineral content there, but spectrographs mounted on board that Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft have been able to see the actual clear signature of significant amounts of regular everyday water, H2O. It's thought that this water actually came about from dustings of snow or frost on the Martian surface that then became compacted and recrystallized as this water ice.
Is there a definitive answer to the question whether water on Earth and now Mars is indigenous to those planets, or if it was somehow seeded by comets or other sources outside of the planet?
The jury is still out as to which one of those processes dominated the establishment of water in either place. We certainly do understand that through volcanic geologic processes, water can be liberated from molten magma such that it can provide a condensate eventually from clouds that are blasted out of volcanoes that could then collect into large amounts of water on a planet like Earth and possibly Mars as well. But there is still some to be said about the idea and about the evidence we've seen about large amounts of ice in space that could have bombarded the planets early on as well. So as to which one, not sure yet.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. This weekend, Imhotep Charter School in Germantown pulled off an impressive sweep. Its boys and girls basketball teams both won public league championships. But the bigger news may be where they won their titles, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman Aaron explains.
Bartram.
It was a conversation that could have taken place in any bar or street corner. Just a couple of cops talking about the good old days of high school basketball in Philadelphia.
What was it? It's called Black Magic. Oh, it was a bunch of guys when I was coming up.
It just so happened that this chat took place right before the boys' city championship and beneath the bleachers at one of the most famous basketball venues in America, the Palestra.
If you've ever been here and you've walked through the halls, you kind of get that feeling.
Jimmy Lynch is president of the Philadelphia Public League.
There's paintings, there's everything. I mean, this is where basketball truly started in the city of Philadelphia.
The University of Pennsylvania's Palestra opened in 1927, but it's been 20 years since the arena hosted the Public League Championship. the school district hopes to reestablish it as the regular site for its biggest game, and in the process recapture some of the league's past glory.
I was introduced when Hank Gathers and Bo Kimble and Doug Overton, Sadie Watson for Franklin. That's when I was introduced.
Fan Samuel Allen has been attending public league title games since the mid-80s, when the league regularly produced pro players.
So I've been in love with it ever since.
These days, he says, most of the top recruits choose Catholic or private schools. But he hopes the Palestra, with so much history and grandeur, can link the league to its past and steer it toward a brighter future. Avi Wolfman-Aaron, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.